Marcus Antonius, Caesar's lieutenant, or Rome's opportunist. Few figures from the final years of the Roman Republic have acquired a reputation as contradictory as Marcus Antonius. To later generations, he became the extravagant lover of Cleopatra, the defeated rival of Octavian, and the last obstacle to the establishment of the Roman Empire. Shakespeare transformed him into one of history's great tragic lovers. Augustan propaganda portrayed him as the Roman who surrendered himself to the luxury of the East. Modern popular history often follows the same path, treating Antony chiefly as a colourful supporting figure in the drama that ends at Actium. Yet this familiar image obscures a more important historical question. Long before Cleopatra entered his life, Marcus Antonius had already become one of the most influential men in the Roman Republic. He fought under Julius Caesar during the Gallic campaigns, held important military commands, served as tribune of the plebs, acted as Caesar's deputy during the Civil War, and stood only a few steps away from him on the morning of the Ides of March. If we wish to understand the final collapse of the Republic, we must first understand the man who occupied that position. Who, then, was Marcus Antonius before history transformed him into Mark Antony? The surviving evidence offers no simple answer. Ancient authors admired his courage, criticized his self-indulgence, praised his generosity, condemned his extravagance, and frequently questioned his political judgment. Friends described loyalty, enemies saw reckless ambition. Later writers, composing under the rule of Augustus, had every reason to present Antony as the defeated opponent whose failure justified the new order. Even sympathetic accounts were written generations after the events they describe. Like every major figure of the late Republic, Antony reaches us through sources that demand careful reading. Cicero wrote as a political enemy. Plutarch sought moral character more than strict chronology. Appian and Cassius Dio viewed the Republic through the experience of the empire that followed. Suetonius preserved valuable traditions, but delighted in anecdote. Caesar himself, whose judgment might seem the most valuable of all, says remarkably little about Antony in his own surviving works. That silence is itself worth considering. This essay, therefore, does not attempt another biography, nor does it seek either to condemn or to rehabilitate Marcus Antonius. Its purpose is more limited, but perhaps more revealing. It asks what the surviving evidence allows us to say about Antony's character before the dramatic events that made him famous. Was he primarily a gifted soldier whose abilities were overshadowed by later failures? Was he an ambitious politician who attached himself to Caesar because he recognized the future? Did Caesar trust him more than history remembers? Or was Antony, from the beginning, a man whose strengths and weaknesses existed side by side, becoming more visible as the Republic itself descended into civil war? These questions matter for more than Antony alone. Caesar's achievements were not accomplished in isolation. Every successful commander depends upon trusted subordinates, capable administrators, and loyal political allies. If Antony occupied such a position, then understanding his character becomes part of understanding Caesar himself. Only by setting aside the later legend of Antony and Cleopatra can we begin to see the younger Marcus Antonius as his contemporaries knew him. Not yet the defeated triumvir, but an ambitious Roman aristocrat attempting to find his place in an increasingly unstable republic. Marcus Antonius was born on the 14th of January 83 BC into one of Rome's oldest plebeian families. The Antonii had held high office for generations and could trace their ancestry, according to later tradition, to Anton, a son of Heracles. Like many Roman aristocratic genealogies, such claims belonged more to family prestige than to verifiable history, but they illustrate an important point. Antony entered public life not as an outsider, but as a member of Rome's established political elite. His inheritance, however, was mixed. His grandfather, Marcus Antonius, had been one of the Republic's finest orators and had served as consul in 99 BC before falling victim to the violence unleashed during the struggle between Marius and Sulla. In 87 BC, he was murdered on the orders of the Marian regime, and his severed head was displayed in the Forum. Antony never knew his grandfather, yet such memories remained part of his family's identity. Like many Roman noble houses, the Antonii carried both distinguished achievements and bitter political wounds into the next generation.
His father, also named Marcus Antonius and remembered by contemporaries as Creticus, achieved far less distinction. Appointed to command operations against piracy in the eastern Mediterranean, he performed so unsuccessfully that the nickname, intended to commemorate his campaign, became a source of ridicule rather than honour. Ancient writers portray him as well-meaning but ineffective, a man whose generosity exceeded his judgment. Whether this assessment is entirely fair is impossible to determine, but it suggests that Antony did not inherit either immense wealth or an unblemished political reputation. His mother, Julia, belonged to the Julian family and was therefore distantly related to Julius Caesar. The exact degree of kinship was not especially close, yet in Roman aristocratic society, even distant family connections could acquire political significance. It is tempting to imagine that this relationship later contributed to Antony's association with Caesar, although the surviving evidence does not allow us to say so with confidence. The ancient sources paint an unflattering picture of Antony's youth. They describe heavy debts, extravagant living, and friendships with equally notorious young aristocrats, particularly Publius Clodius Pulcher. Cicero, who became Antony's fiercest political opponent, presents these years as little more than a catalogue of excess and irresponsibility. His speeches depict Antony as a drunkard, gambler, and libertine, whose private conduct revealed a fundamentally defective character. Such portraits demand caution. Cicero was not writing impartial biography. The Philippics were political speeches delivered in the desperate months following Caesar's assassination, intended to persuade the Senate that Antony represented a mortal danger to the Republic. Character assassination formed an accepted part of Roman political rhetoric, and accusations of drunkenness, sexual misconduct, financial irresponsibility, and moral corruption were common weapons against political opponents. Modern historians therefore hesitate to accept Cicero's descriptions at face value. Yet neither should they be dismissed entirely. Independent sources suggest that Antony did accumulate substantial debts while still a young man. Roman aristocratic politics encouraged lavish expenditure on houses, clients, public appearances, and personal reputation. But Antony seems to have exceeded even the generous standards of his own class. Whether this reflected irresponsibility, youthful confidence, or calculated investment in future political success remains open to debate. debt was hardly unusual among ambitious Roman nobles. Julius Caesar himself repeatedly borrowed enormous sums during his rise to power. The existence of debt alone therefore tells us little about Antony's character. What matters is how he attempted to escape it. That opportunity appeared in the East. Around 57 BC, Antony left Rome and entered military service under Aulus Gabinius, the governor of Syria. It proved a decisive change. Removed from the intrigues of Roman politics, Antony demonstrated qualities that even hostile sources rarely deny. He showed courage in battle, adapted quickly to military life, and gained practical experience commanding cavalry. During Gabinius's intervention in Egypt to restore Ptolemy XII to the throne, Antony reportedly distinguished himself through personal bravery and energetic leadership. It is striking that the criticisms so prominent in accounts of Antony's civilian life become noticeably quieter once he enters military service. This pattern will recur throughout his career. Again and again, the sources describe a man who appeared most capable when campaigning with an army, less convincing when managing political compromise in Rome. Whether this reflected his own temperament or simply the preferences of our surviving authors remains uncertain. But it is a distinction worth keeping in mind from the outset. By the late 50s BC, Marcus Antonius had acquired something far more valuable than temporary escape from creditors. He had gained military experience, developed a reputation for personal courage, and begun to establish connections among commanders operating far from Rome. These experiences prepared him for the encounter that would shape the remainder of his life. In 54 BC, Antony entered the service of Julius Caesar in Gaul. Neither man could yet have known how profoundly that decision would alter the history of the Roman Republic. It is where our investigation must begin. When Marcus Antonius joined Julius Caesar in Gaul around 54 BC, the conquest was already well advanced. The Helvetii had been defeated, Ariovistus driven back across the Rhine, and much of central Gaul had submitted to Roman authority. Caesar was no longer merely a provincial governor. He had become one of the Republic's most successful commanders, leading an army that had acquired enormous experience through almost continuous campaigning.
For a young aristocrat seeking advancement, there could hardly have been a better place to serve. Yet joining Caesar's army did not guarantee prominence. His staff already contained experienced officers, talented engineers, and trusted political associates. Titus Labienus had been with Caesar from the beginning of the Gallic command and had repeatedly demonstrated exceptional military ability. Quintus Cicero, Gaius Trebonius, Decimus Brutus, and several others also occupied important positions at different stages of the campaign. Antony, therefore, entered an established command structure rather than becoming one of Caesar's immediate confidants. This point deserves emphasis because later events easily distort our perspective. Knowing the importance Antony would later assume, it is tempting to imagine that Caesar recognized his future lieutenant almost immediately. The surviving evidence suggests something more gradual. Caesar himself rarely pauses to praise individual officers. Throughout the commentaries, he deliberately directs the reader's attention toward operations rather than personalities. His own achievements are presented with remarkable restraint, while subordinate commanders generally appear only when their actions become essential to understanding the campaign. Antony is therefore mentioned less frequently than modern readers might expect.
not necessarily because he lacked importance, but because Caesar's literary method avoids turning military history into personal memoir. Even so, Antony's appearances are significant. By the later Gallic campaigns, he was entrusted with independent responsibilities, commanded troops during important operations, and was repeatedly employed where reliability mattered. Such appointments were not distributed casually. Caesar's army operated hundreds of miles from Rome, often in hostile territory, where communication with Italy could take weeks. A commander delegated with independent authority required more than courage. He needed judgment, discipline, and, above all, personal loyalty. It is this last quality that perhaps deserves the greatest attention. The political atmosphere surrounding Caesar grew steadily more dangerous during the final years of the Gallic War. Relations with Pompey deteriorated, the Senate became increasingly divided, and the possibility of civil conflict slowly emerged from political speculation into practical reality. Under such circumstances, every appointment carried political as well as military significance. Caesar was not merely choosing capable officers. He was identifying the men upon whom he might one day depend for his own survival. Antony increasingly belonged to that circle. This does not mean that Caesar regarded him as his most gifted subordinate. Ancient and modern historians alike usually award that distinction to Titus Labienus, whose tactical skill was beyond question. Ironically, Labienus would later abandon Caesar and join Pompey at the outbreak of the Civil War. Military brilliance, it turned out, did not guarantee political loyalty. Antony represented something rather different. If Labienus embodied professional military excellence, Antony appears to have offered unwavering personal commitment. Again and again, when political decisions rather than battlefield manoeuvres became decisive, Caesar turned to Antony. That pattern becomes increasingly visible after the Gallic campaigns and suggests that Caesar valued qualities extending beyond technical military competence. Exactly what those qualities were is more difficult to determine. Personal courage seems beyond dispute. Even hostile writers rarely question Antony's willingness to expose himself to danger. Ancient commanders observed one another closely in battle, and cowardice was almost impossible to conceal over years of campaigning. Antony's reputation for physical bravery remained remarkably consistent throughout his life. He also appears to have possessed considerable personal charisma. Roman armies were not anonymous machines. Soldiers responded to commanders who shared hardships, displayed confidence under pressure, and cultivated loyalty among their men. Plutarch repeatedly hints that Antony possessed precisely this ability. Although he could be undisciplined in civilian life, he inspired affection among soldiers in the field. Such qualities cannot easily be measured, yet they often determine whether armies remain cohesive during prolonged campaigns. There was, however, another side to Antony's personality. The same energy that impressed soldiers sometimes translated into impatience in politics. Ancient writers repeatedly contrast Caesar's extraordinary capacity for calculation with Antony's more impulsive temperament. Caesar seldom acted without considering several possible outcomes. Antony often appears more willing to trust immediate instinct. Whether this judgment reflects reality or the hindsight of later historians remains uncertain. But it raises an important question.
Did Caesar recognize these weaknesses? It is difficult to believe that he did not. Caesar was an exceptionally perceptive judge of men. Throughout his career, he demonstrated an almost uncanny ability to identify talent, reward loyalty, and understand the ambitions of those around him.
He certainly misjudged individuals on occasion. Decimus Brutus remains the obvious example, but such errors were comparatively rare. If Antony possessed flaws of temperament, Caesar almost certainly recognized them. The more interesting possibility is that he considered those flaws acceptable. Successful commanders rarely seek subordinates identical to themselves. They require different qualities for different tasks. Caesar's greatest strength lay in strategic vision, political calculation, and extraordinary self-control. Antony offered something complementary: energy, boldness, popularity with the army, and an unquestioned willingness to commit himself fully to Caesar's cause. Whether these qualities outweighed his weaknesses would become one of the central questions of the Civil War. For the moment, however, one conclusion already seems justified. By the time the Gallic campaigns approached their end, Marcus Antonius was no longer merely another ambitious young aristocrat serving under Rome's most successful general. He had become one of the comparatively small group of men whom Caesar trusted with responsibilities extending beyond the battlefield. That trust would soon be tested in circumstances neither commander could any longer avoid. The political struggle that had been gathering in Rome for years was about to become open civil war. The outbreak of the civil war in 49 BC transformed Marcus Antonius from a promising subordinate into one of Julius Caesar's principal lieutenants. It also subjected his abilities to a far more demanding test than anything he had faced in Gaul. Campaigning against foreign tribes required courage, discipline, and tactical skill. Civil war demanded something altogether different. Every decision now carried political as well as military consequences, and every success or failure influenced the future of the Republic itself. When the Senate ordered Caesar to surrender his command and return to Rome as a private citizen, Antony stood firmly at his side. As tribune of the plebs, he attempted to exercise the traditional right of veto against the measures directed at Caesar. According to the ancient sources, he and his fellow tribune, Quintus Cassius, found themselves threatened to such an extent that they fled Rome, disguised as ordinary travellers, before joining Caesar at Ravenna. Whether every detail of that dramatic escape is historically accurate has long been debated. Caesar himself naturally presented the violation of the tribunes as powerful evidence that constitutional government had broken down. If magistrates, whose persons were legally sacrosanct, could no longer exercise their office freely, then, Caesar argued, extraordinary measures had become necessary. Antony, therefore, became not merely a political supporter, but part of Caesar's constitutional justification for crossing the Rubicon. This is one of the earliest occasions on which Antony's personal loyalty assumed genuine historical importance. Many senators who had previously cooperated with Caesar hesitated as political tensions increased. Others attempted to mediate between the opposing camps. Antony chose neither course. From the beginning of the crisis, he identified his own fortunes completely with those of Caesar. Whether this decision reflected conviction, personal ambition, or simple recognition that his future depended upon Caesar is impossible to determine with certainty. The motives need not even have been mutually exclusive. Roman politics rarely separated principle from personal advancement as neatly as modern observers sometimes imagine. Loyalty itself could be both sincere and politically advantageous.
Whatever Antony's reasons, Caesar rewarded that loyalty generously. During the opening stages of the Civil War, Antony was entrusted with increasingly important responsibilities. While Caesar campaigned in Spain and later crossed into Greece in pursuit of Pompey,
Antony remained responsible for significant military and political duties in Italy. Such appointments reveal more about Caesar's confidence than any formal declaration could have done. Delegating authority in one's absence is perhaps the clearest measure of trust any commander can offer. The appointment that best illustrates this confidence came after the decisive victory at Pharsalus in 48 BC. Caesar named Antony Magister Equitum, Master of Horse, the traditional deputy to the dictator. Although the ancient title retained echoes of Rome's earliest constitutional arrangements, its practical significance during Caesar's dictatorship was unmistakable. Antony became the second most powerful man within Caesar's administration whenever Caesar himself was absent. It was an extraordinary position for someone who, only a few years earlier, had still been establishing his reputation in Gaul. Yet it was precisely here that the first clear signs of difficulty appeared. Military command and political administration demanded different qualities. Ancient writers generally agree that Antony remained an energetic and capable commander in the field. Governing Rome proved considerably more difficult. While Caesar campaigned abroad, Antony found himself confronted by financial disputes, political rivalries, and increasing social unrest. The Republic had been thrown into civil war, debts had accumulated throughout Italy, veterans expected rewards, creditors demanded payment, and competing political factions sought advantage from every uncertainty. No administrator could have satisfied every interest. Nevertheless, Antony's conduct attracted criticism from several directions. Even writers sympathetic to Caesar suggest that his administration lacked the careful balance and calculated restraint that characterized Caesar's own political style. Antony could be forceful where compromise might have proved wiser, and impatient where Caesar usually preferred negotiation. The conflict with Publius Cornelius Dolabella illustrates the problem. Dolabella, one of Caesar's supporters and later his son-in-law, proposed sweeping measures to relieve debt by cancelling or reducing financial obligations. Popular among many debtors, these proposals alarmed creditors and threatened wider economic instability. Antony opposed them, and the dispute eventually descended into violence within Rome itself. The surviving sources disagree over responsibility. Cicero naturally portrays Antony as brutal and incompetent. Other accounts place greater emphasis upon the exceptional circumstances confronting any government during civil war. The truth probably lies somewhere between these extremes. Antony inherited problems that admitted no easy solution. Yet he appears to have lacked Caesar's remarkable instinct for transforming political confrontation into workable compromise. This difference deserves attention. Throughout his career, Caesar displayed an extraordinary ability to reconcile former enemies whenever circumstances allowed. His policy of clemencia, whether motivated by calculation, principle, or both, consistently sought to reduce the number of Romans who believed themselves permanently excluded from political life. Antony possessed courage in equal measure. He does not seem to have possessed the same instinct for conciliation. That distinction would become increasingly important after Caesar's death. Yet we should resist judging Antony solely by what followed. Despite these administrative difficulties, Caesar never withdrew his confidence. He neither removed Antony from high office nor replaced him with another lieutenant. On the contrary, Antony remained one of the few men regularly entrusted with responsibilities extending across both military and political affairs. That continued confidence is itself historical evidence. Caesar was neither sentimental nor careless in his choice of subordinates. Throughout his career, he promoted men according to usefulness rather than friendship alone. If Antony retained such prominence despite evident shortcomings, we must at least consider the possibility that Caesar believed his strengths continued to outweigh his weaknesses. What those strengths were has become increasingly clear. He inspired soldiers. He remained personally loyal. He acted decisively in moments of crisis. He accepted responsibilities from which others shrank. Against these qualities stood equally visible limitations: impatience, occasional lack of political judgment, and a tendency to meet confrontation with force rather than persuasion.
By the middle of the 40s BC, Marcus Antonius had become a man of immense influence. He was also becoming a man upon whom the future of the Republic might unexpectedly depend. Neither he nor Caesar could yet know how soon that moment would arrive. By the middle of the 40s BC, Marcus Antonius stood near the centre of Roman political life. Caesar's victories had destroyed organised military resistance, yet peace had not restored political harmony. Many former opponents had accepted Caesar's clemency, resumed public office, and returned to the Senate. Outwardly, Rome appeared calmer than it had for years. Beneath the surface, however, resentment, uncertainty, and wounded ambition remained. Antony moved within this complicated political landscape as Caesar's most visible lieutenant. It is therefore worth asking, not merely how Antony viewed Caesar, but how he was regarded by those around him. His relationship with the future conspirators appears, at first sight, surprisingly ordinary. Marcus Junius Brutus had accepted Caesar's pardon after Pharsalus and had subsequently received important offices. Gaius Cassius Longinus had likewise been reconciled with Caesar, despite having fought on Pompey's side. Decimus Junius Brutus, perhaps the most astonishing example of Caesar's generosity, enjoyed not only forgiveness, but continued confidence. Caesar entrusted him with military commands and even named him among the secondary heirs in his will. There is little evidence that Antony regarded any of these men as immediate enemies. Nor, for that matter, is there convincing evidence that they regarded Antony as one. This observation deserves emphasis because hindsight easily colours our judgment. Knowing that Brutus, Cassius, and Decimus would eventually murder Caesar, it is tempting to imagine the political world already divided into two opposing camps. The surviving evidence suggests something much more fluid. Romans who had fought one another only a few years earlier now sat together in the Senate. Former enemies served as magistrates under Caesar's authority. Political conversations continued. Friendships survived across earlier loyalties. The Republic had become deeply unstable, but it had not yet split into two clearly defined factions. Antony himself illustrates this ambiguity. Unlike some of Caesar's more uncompromising supporters, he does not appear to have pursued systematic revenge against former Pompeians. His public conduct before the assassination suggests confidence rather than suspicion. If he feared an organized conspiracy, the ancient sources give remarkably little indication of it. This raises an obvious question. How close was Antony personally to Brutus? The answer is almost certainly less dramatic than later literature sometimes suggests. Brutus and Antony belonged to the same aristocratic political world.
they knew one another well enough to cooperate in public affairs, attend the same meetings, and participate in the same Senate. Yet no ancient source describes an especially close friendship between them. Nor do we possess convincing evidence of sustained personal hostility before the assassination. Their relationship seems to have been characterized by professional familiarity rather than intimacy. The same appears broadly true of Cassius. Cassius had earned distinction as a soldier long before joining the conspiracy, and possessed a reputation for intelligence, determination, and political independence. Antony undoubtedly respected his abilities. Whether he trusted him is another matter. But the sources offer little evidence that either man openly anticipated the fatal conflict approaching them. Decimus Brutus presents a more intriguing case. Unlike Marcus Brutus or Cassius, Decimus had served with Caesar in Gaul and had proved himself one of his most capable military commanders. If Antony regarded anyone among the future conspirators as unquestionably loyal to Caesar, Decimus would surely have ranked near the top of the list. That assumption would prove catastrophically mistaken. It also reminds us how difficult personal judgment could become during periods of political transformation. Caesar himself failed to recognize Decimus's intentions until it was too late. Antony can hardly be criticized for making the same error. One relationship, however, deserves particular attention because it has generated more speculation than evidence. Servilia. As the mother of Brutus and the long-standing companion of Caesar, Servilia occupied a unique position within the Roman aristocracy. Ancient writers leave little doubt that Caesar held deep affection for her over many years. Their relationship was sufficiently well known to become the subject of political gossip even during Caesar's lifetime. What role, if any, did Antony play within this circle? The honest answer is that we do not know. Modern biographies occasionally hint at personal tensions or political rivalries involving Servilia, Antony, and Caesar, but the surviving ancient evidence is remarkably limited. Servilia undoubtedly remained an influential political figure. After the assassination, meetings involving Brutus and other leading senators took place in her house, demonstrating that she continued to exercise considerable authority within aristocratic society. Yet influence should not be confused with conspiracy, nor should political proximity be mistaken for personal intimacy. There is no reliable ancient testimony suggesting a romantic relationship between Antony and Servilia. Equally, there is little reason to believe that Antony regarded her as an enemy before the Ides of March. She belonged to the complex network of noble families within which Roman politics operated, where personal friendships, family alliances, and political disagreements frequently overlapped without producing clear divisions. Perhaps the most revealing relationship of all was not with Brutus, Cassius, or Servilia, but with Gaius Trebonius. Trebonius had fought beside Caesar in Gaul, held important commands during the Civil War, and enjoyed Caesar's continued confidence. Nothing in Antony's dealings with him appears unusual. Indeed, on the morning of March 15th, 44 BC, Trebonius approached Antony with apparent friendliness, engaged him in conversation outside the theatre of Pompey, and quietly prevented him from entering the Senate House while the assassination was taking place. The simplicity of the deception is striking. Trebonius evidently believed Antony would suspect nothing, More remarkably still, he proved correct. That single episode tells us something important about the atmosphere of Caesar's final months. Whatever private disagreements existed among Rome's political elite, ordinary social interaction continued almost until the final moment. Men, who would soon become murderers, conversed easily with those who would shortly become their enemies. Public life preserved an appearance of normality long after confidence had begun to disappear. Antony, like Caesar himself, seems to have accepted that appearance. Whether this reflected confidence, optimism, or dangerous misjudgment remains one of the central questions surrounding the Ides of March. The answer requires us to examine the events of that day itself. No day in Roman history has attracted more legend than the Ides of March in 44 BC. Ancient historians, dramatists, and modern novelists alike have filled its hours with ominous dreams, prophetic warnings, and carefully rehearsed conspiracies. Yet, behind these familiar stories lies a far simpler historical question. How did Marcus Antonius behave when Julius Caesar was murdered? The answer begins before the first dagger was drawn. On the morning of March 15th, Caesar made his way towards the meeting of the Senate, which had been convened in the Curia of Pompey rather than in the Forum. Antony accompanied him for part of the journey, exactly as might be expected of Caesar's closest political associate and holder of the office of Master of Horse. He never entered the chamber. According to Plutarch, Appian, and other ancient writers, Gaius Trebonius deliberately intercepted Antony outside the building and engaged him in conversation. The purpose was obvious. Of all the men surrounding Caesar, Antony alone possessed both the physical presence and the political authority that might have disrupted the conspiracy. Even if he could not have saved Caesar, his intervention might have prevented the assassins from escaping or forced them to abandon their plan altogether. Trebonius therefore ensured that Antony remained outside until the deed had been accomplished. The simplicity of the arrangement has often surprised historians. There was no struggle, no attempt to arrest Antony, no violence directed against him. Trebonius merely delayed him. That fact deserves careful consideration. The conspirators clearly regarded Antony as dangerous, but not as suspicious. They expected him to accept an ordinary conversation with a political colleague, without imagining that anything extraordinary was taking place a few meters away. The plan succeeded because Antony trusted appearances. Whether that trust reflected confidence, political complacency, or simply the absence of any concrete warning remains impossible to determine. Several ancient authors record rumors that Caesar had received anonymous warnings of a conspiracy, while others describe dreams, omens, and repeated attempts to persuade him not to attend the meeting. Most of these stories belong to literary tradition rather than verifiable history. What concerns us here is something much simpler. Neither Caesar nor Antony behaved as men expecting an assassination. That observation is important. Modern readers often assume that the political atmosphere had become so poisonous that violence seemed inevitable. The evidence suggests otherwise. Political tensions were certainly profound, but assassination remained an extraordinary act. Caesar had pardoned many of the men who now surrounded him. They continued to hold office, attend Senate meetings, and converse with him as before. Even Antony, whose position placed him nearest to Caesar, appears to have anticipated another ordinary day of government. When the attack finally came, events unfolded with astonishing speed. The surviving sources differ over details, but they agree on the essential sequence. Caesar was surrounded under the pretext of presenting a petition. Tilius Cimber seized his toga. The first blow was struck. Within moments, dozens of senators had joined the assault. Antony was not there. Some later writers criticized him for failing to protect Caesar. Such criticism seems deeply unfair. Everything we know about the conspiracy suggests that his absence resulted precisely from the conspirators' planning. Had Antony entered the chamber beside Caesar, events might indeed have unfolded differently. Equally, he may simply have become another victim. The Senate House was crowded with armed conspirators. One additional man, however courageous, could not easily have overcome more than 20 determined assassins acting at close quarters. The question, therefore, is not why Antony failed to prevent the murder. The more revealing question is what he did afterwards. The immediate reaction appears entirely human. Believing that he himself might be the conspirator's next target, Antony withdrew from the forum, exchanged his official dress for ordinary clothing, and sought temporary refuge. Ancient authors occasionally present this retreat as evidence of fear. Perhaps it was. If so, it was hardly irrational. No one yet knew whether the conspirators intended to kill Caesar alone or to eliminate all his principal supporters. Antony had every reason to believe that his own life was in immediate danger. The conspirators had already demonstrated a willingness to use political murder as an instrument of policy. Caution under such circumstances should not automatically be mistaken for cowardice. Indeed, Antony's conduct over the following days suggests quite the opposite. Once it became clear that the conspirators had no immediate plan to pursue Caesar's supporters, Antony re-emerged with remarkable speed. Rather than abandoning public life or attempting to organize military resistance, he entered negotiations with the Senate and the leading conspirators. Temporary compromise still seemed possible. This point is often overlooked. The Republic did not descend instantly into renewed civil war on the afternoon of March 15th. For a brief and fragile moment, both sides explored reconciliation. Antony participated actively in those efforts. He agreed that Caesar's appointments should remain valid. The conspirators, in return, received temporary protection through an amnesty proposed in the Senate. Neither side obtained everything it wanted, but both recognized that another civil war might destroy what remained of the Republic. For a few days, moderation appeared to prevail. Yet beneath that compromise lay a problem neither party had fully appreciated. Caesar himself was dead. His authority had vanished. The delicate balance that had depended upon his personal judgment disappeared with him. It is here that Antony's own political instincts faced their greatest test. For years, he had acted as Caesar's lieutenant. Now, for the first time, he would be required to act without Caesar. Whether he possessed the qualities necessary for that role remained entirely uncertain. The answer would begin to emerge only a few days later, when Rome gathered to honour the dead dictator. Few speeches in history have become as famous as the one Marcus Antonius delivered over Caesar's body. Ironically, it is almost certainly a speech that no one can now reconstruct with confidence. For most readers, Antony's funeral oration is inseparable from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. The repeated refrain, "Friends, Romans, countrymen," has become one of the best-known passages in English literature. Yet Shakespeare was writing more than 16 centuries after the event and drew freely upon Plutarch while shaping the drama to suit the stage. His Antony is a brilliant theatrical creation, but he is not a historical transcript. The ancient evidence is considerably more restrained. Neither Caesar's contemporaries nor the later historians preserve the speech itself. Appian, Cassius Dio, and Plutarch each describe Antony's conduct, but they differ in emphasis and detail. Like many ancient historians, they frequently reconstructed speeches that expressed what they believed ought to have been said, rather than recording the exact words actually spoken. This distinction matters. If we wish to understand Antony's character, we must examine not the speech itself, but its consequences. Those consequences were extraordinary. Only a few days earlier, Antony had helped negotiate a fragile compromise between the conspirators and the Senate. Caesar's acts remained valid. The assassins received temporary protection. The possibility, however slight, still existed that Rome might avoid another civil war. The funeral altered that balance completely. According to the ancient accounts, Antony displayed Caesar's blood-stained toga before the assembled crowd and reminded the people of the victories, honours, and generosity of the murdered dictator. Caesar's will, which provided generous gifts to the Roman people and left his gardens for public use, further transformed public feeling. The reaction was immediate. Grief became anger. Anger became violence. The assembled crowd abandoned orderly mourning. Improvised torches were seized. Caesar's body was cremated in the forum rather than at the location originally intended. The mob then turned against the houses of several conspirators, who escaped only with considerable difficulty. Whether Antony deliberately intended this outcome remains one of the most debated questions in the entire episode. Some ancient writers portray him as a master of political theatre, who consciously manipulated public emotion to destroy the compromise he had himself negotiated. Others present events as a spontaneous eruption of popular feeling that quickly escaped anyone's control. The evidence allows no certain answer. What seems beyond dispute is that Antony understood the power of public ceremony. Throughout Roman history, funerals of distinguished statesmen had served not merely to honour the dead, but to remind citizens of ancestral achievements and public service. Antony employed that tradition with exceptional skill. He transformed Caesar's funeral from a private act of mourning into a public demonstration of what Rome had lost. Whether he fully anticipated the crowd's reaction is another matter. Modern historians sometimes attribute to Antony an almost superhuman ability to calculate every consequence. Such certainty seems unwarranted. Public crowds possess a momentum of their own. Once emotion replaces deliberation, events often develop beyond the intentions of those who first set them in motion. Indeed, Antony himself may have discovered that he had released forces he could no longer entirely control. Yet one conclusion appears justified. The funeral revealed a quality that had been less visible during Antony's earlier career. He understood people. Not in the detached and analytical manner that characterized Caesar, but instinctively. He recognized symbols. He understood ceremony. He appreciated the emotional force of public memory. Where Caesar persuaded primarily through argument, calculation, and policy, Antony could appeal directly to feeling. These were different forms of political leadership. Neither was necessarily superior. Both possessed advantages and dangers. This distinction may help explain why Antony proved such an effective lieutenant, yet encountered greater difficulties when acting alone. Caesar's remarkable strength lay in balancing emotion with long-term political calculation. Antony excelled at inspiring immediate loyalty and immediate action. The two men complemented one another. Separated by death, those complementary strengths could no longer operate together. The funeral, therefore, marks more than the end of Caesar's life. It marks the moment at which Antony ceased to be Caesar's deputy and became an independent political actor.
Whether he was prepared for that role remains doubtful. For perhaps the first time in his career, there was no one above him whose judgment could moderate his own impulses, restrain his enthusiasm, or broaden his perspective. The consequences would shape the remaining history of the Republic. Yet before following Antony into the struggles that eventually produced the Second Triumvirate, one final question deserves consideration. What, after all these years beside Caesar, had he actually learned from the man he had served? History has rarely been kind to Marcus Antonius. For the Romans who lived under Augustus, he became the defeated rival whose failure justified the new political order. For Shakespeare, he became the passionate lover whose emotions overwhelmed political judgment. Modern popular history often remembers him chiefly through Cleopatra and Actium, as though the 20 years preceding those events were little more than a prelude to inevitable failure. The surviving evidence suggests a rather different man. Before Caesar's assassination, Antony emerges as an able soldier, a courageous commander, and, above all, an exceptionally loyal subordinate. He repeatedly accepted responsibilities that required personal commitment rather than political caution. He stood beside Caesar when others abandoned him, remained faithful throughout the civil war, and received from Caesar a degree of confidence that few men ever attained. That confidence should not be underestimated. Julius Caesar was an extraordinarily perceptive judge of men. Throughout his career, he rewarded talent wherever he found it, yet he seldom confused personal affection with political usefulness. He promoted officers because they were capable, not because they were agreeable. If he continued to entrust Antony with increasingly important responsibilities, despite occasional administrative shortcomings, it seems reasonable to conclude that he believed Antony's strengths outweighed his weaknesses. What were those strengths? Personal courage appears beyond serious dispute. His ability to inspire soldiers is repeatedly confirmed by ancient writers of very different political sympathies. His loyalty to Caesar remained remarkably consistent during years in which many others changed sides. Even after the assassination, when his own life seemed in danger, Antony recovered quickly enough to negotiate with Caesar's enemies and attempt, however briefly, to preserve public order. Yet the weaknesses visible before the Ides of March also remained. Again and again, the sources suggest a man who responded more readily to immediate circumstances than to long-term political calculation. Caesar possessed an extraordinary ability to reconcile opponents, postpone conflict, and transform victory into durable political advantage. Antony possessed no comparable instinct. His gifts lay elsewhere.
He excelled in action more than in restraint, in inspiration more than in administration, in personal leadership more than constitutional compromise. This difference may explain why Antony proved such an outstanding lieutenant while encountering greater difficulties as an independent leader. Serving Caesar, his strengths complemented those of his commander. Without Caesar, the balance disappeared. It would, however, be mistaken to conclude that Antony's later failures invalidate Caesar's earlier judgment. Historical figures should be understood within the circumstances in which they acted, not merely through the knowledge of what followed. Caesar did not require another Caesar. He required men capable of carrying out difficult commands, inspiring armies, and remaining loyal under immense political pressure. In those respects, Antony justified the confidence placed in him. Whether anyone could have succeeded in preserving Caesar's political settlement after the Ides of March is a different question altogether. The republic that Antony inherited in March 44 BC was not the republic that Caesar had entered half a century earlier. Decades of civil conflict, political violence, and personal rivalry had already weakened the habits upon which republican government ultimately depended. Antony's character influenced the events that followed, but he did not create the conditions in which they unfolded. Perhaps that is the most important conclusion to draw. Individuals matter profoundly in history, yet they never act in isolation. Antony's virtues and faults shaped the final years of the Republic, but they did so within a political system that had already become dangerously unstable. To attribute Rome's fate solely to his decisions would simplify a far more complex reality.
Who then was Marcus Antonius before he became the famous Antony of Cleopatra? The answer is neither a reckless adventurer nor a tragic romantic hero. He was a capable soldier, a charismatic leader of men, and one of Julius Caesar's most trusted lieutenants. He possessed courage in abundance, loyalty that few questioned, and political gifts that could be formidable. At the same time, he lacked the extraordinary combination of patience, calculation, and constitutional imagination that distinguished Caesar from almost every statesman of his generation. The contrast between the two men reminds us that history often turns not merely upon ability, but upon the particular kind of ability required at a particular moment. Marcus Antonius was precisely the man Caesar needed while Caesar lived. Whether he was the man Rome needed after Caesar's death is another question, one that history itself would answer.